Archbishop, Bishop, ladies and gentlemen, it's an honour to speak to you today in this place and in this company. Can you hear me? Start again. The point about the word is that there are always failures in it, as well as communication. It's an honour to speak to you today. In this place and in this company, and thank you. And both poetry and prayer have meant so many different things down the centuries. Prayer can be poetry, and poetry can be prayer. They're close cousins, perhaps, but they're not the same. And I thought I'd start laying out my story with three themes: how I think they differ, what they have in common, and what they give to each other. And I started at the very simple linguistic level. To pray is a verb, but there is no verb for to poetize, to engage with poetry. And if there were, what would it mean? It wouldn't mean to write a poem, because one person does that, and then the poem is there, and an infinite number of people can read it. Is it to read a poem? We might only do that once. I think what it would mean is let it matter to you, let it go on mattering. Think about what a poem is and what the words are. So here immediately is a difference. Prayer as an abstract word, as an idea, somehow carries with it an act, an activity. You are at prayer. But if you think of a prayer, a single prayer, the equivalent of that is not a poetry. It's a poem. And I think poetry, unlike prayer, soon scatters off into a more concrete individual thing, the poems. Poetry goes, and it works best when it goes into the concrete. It also, of course, stays with the spiritual, but it is manifest in single poems. But what they have in common, both provide opportunity to transform an individual's innerness into something that praises and engages with the world. And it does so in words, in language. And both poetry and prayer, I think, treat communication, the way we relate to each other, as sacred, but as sacred in words. And I was thinking of Rilke, the German poet. He seems to think that the chance to transform our inner selves is like a makeshift hut with a scrap of torn cloth nailed over it against the wind. Our innerness and our inner poverty is what Orpheus, that's poetry, song, structured rhythm, can transform into a temple. And this is just from one of the sonnets of Orpheus. Where there had been just a makeshift hut to receive the music, a shelter nailed up out of their darkest longing, with an entryway that shuddered in the wind, you built a temple deep inside their hearing. Well, that makeshift hut is the depth of longing that Rilke himself wrote out of, and I think it's the transformation of it which made the Russian poet Marina Tsvetaeva say that Rilke was poetry. But of course, the makeshift hut is also a symbol, an emblem, a metaphor. And it's in this use of something that is not the whole thing, not perhaps the thing you're talking about, the metaphor, the language aside, the image, which opens new meanings. I mean, I think of metaphors in the poem sometimes like stained glass in a cathedral, that you look on it, it's a colour which is different, and you can see new things in and through it. And I was once, as a personal note here, I once had the beginning and end of a poem. It was when I was researching wild tigers, and I was in Vladivostok, and I woke up very early. My daughter was with me, and she was just about to go back home to Britain, and I was going to go into the forests. And I was sad she was going. And I also had this poem in my head, these two first and last lines. And suddenly I was given the memory of George Herbert's famous poem, Prayer, which I'm sure one of us will read later on. And one of the things about that sonnet is it's just a string of images for what prayer is. And I thought, maybe I could do that in homage to Herbert. Maybe I could just, my title was Tiger Drinking in Forest Pool. And I thought, maybe the in-between lines between the first and the last could just be a string of images for what a tiger drinking in a pool can mean. So both prayer and poetry, I think, operate vitally through symbol and image. And again, Rilke, he suggests that putting words together in the best way is really what we're here for, and it seems to me that that is both prayer and poetry. And in the ninth Guarino elegy, he says, when the traveller returns from the mountain slopes to the valley, he brings not a handful of earth unsayable to others, but instead some word he has gained, some pure word, the yellow and blue gentian. Perhaps we are here in order to say house, bridge, fountain, gate, jug, fruit tree, window. Here is the time for the sayable. Here is its homeland. Speak and bear witness. And each thing, poetry and prayer, or a poem and a prayer, is a place where language matters. Both of them resist easy speech, and they get, I think, harder as you go on, as you practice poetry. And I would hazard, I would guess, as you practice prayer, a life of prayer, as a life of poetry, you want, it's continually harder, and so it should be. You have to discipline your words and your thinkings, resist what's easy. You're also drawing on a huge tradition and trying in your tiny way to add to it, a rich tradition. And this is what I think you have in Little Gidding, where I think possibly I need to end. We're only having 10 minutes this first part, and then we will come back with each other, I hope. Little Gidding is a poem written, as I'm sure you know, while Eliot was firefighting in the Blitz in London. And he saw many tragic and difficult things. And he was remembering this beautiful place, not that far from here. It was a kind of sanctuary for him to rest his mind on. And he says, you're here to kneel where prayer has been valid. It is the sense of the tradition of words, of the act. And prayer is more than an order of words, the conscious occupation of the praying mind, or the sound of the voice praying. And then he goes on to what both prayer and poetry are, or prayer and a poem. Every phrase and sentence that is right, every word is at home, taking its place to support the others. The word neither diffident nor ostentatious. An easy commerce of the old and the new. The common word exact without vulgarity. The formal word precise but not pedantic. The complete consort dancing together. Well, a poem and a prayer, I think, are both acts and collections of consorts of words that seek to be open. You hope that your work will open a gateway, like an icon, in which ordinary world is sort of broken up and reconnected, so that you can offer something, new meanings to people. And in a way, see more of the world, possibilities in the world. I was reading recently about the eye of a mammal, any mammal, all of us. We have rods and cones which make electrical activity out of light waves by means of tiny changes of pigment in the cells. And this only takes a tiny part of a second. But while it's happening, the cell is busy processing the light and it can't let in any more light. So what we actually see are a series of stills, a series of snapshots of the world while the cell is busy. And the rate at which this happens is called the flicker fusion rate. That's the number of snapshots we have of the world every second. And that, for us humans, is 60 snapshots a second. But a dog has 70 or 80. And it isn't that the dog sees the world faster, it's that it sees a little bit more of the world. It lets in more light. And in a way, I think that's what a poem or a prayer hopes to do. They are both a place of relationship, a place of trust. The poet has to trust the reader to receive and hear and attend to the words. And attention, Simone Weil said that absolute attention is a form of prayer. And the reader has to trust the poet that these words might seem difficult, and you may have to read them again. You have to trust that it's worthwhile, that you will gain a meaning that enlightens and enriches you. So it's a two-way relationship and a two-way trust involved in both poem and prayer. And I thought I would show you this. It's also a very concentrated place. This thing here, I hope you can see it on the screens, is actually an inch long. It's a little gold flake from the 4th century before Christ. And it's written in Greek. And it is a prayer. And it says, it's a prayer for, it's just a little gold ticket to salvation. The dying soul is told how to operate in the afterlife, where to go. And it says in its 6 tiny lines, I am parched with thirst and dying, but drink of me, the everlasting spring, where there is a white cypress on the right. Who are you? Where are you? I am the son of earth and star-filled heaven, but my race is heavenly. So, for me, that's an image of both prayer and of poetry. And I was thinking, what do they give each other? Well, what poetry offers prayer is art, is delight in words and artifice, which is not artificial, but art for making, like the sculpture that has made this, like Gisalbertus. And so it has given prayer, the psalms, hymns, the Rigveda, verbal patterning, which as an outer form of an inner spiritual rhyming and consonance. Well, what prayer offers poetry, I think, is the way that the touchstone has to be genuine, and it has to be your genuine. Your poem can lie as much as it likes factually, but it's got to be true to your own individual imagination and emotions, otherwise it won't work. And I think both prayer and poetry are places where what is good is what works. A bad poem is not poetry, and a false prayer is not prayer. And it's one of the tragedies of Hamlet's uncle that we see him when he knows truly that he cannot truly pray. My words fly up, my thoughts remain below. Words without thoughts never to heaven go. So I suppose if you think of prayer, of poetry, as heightened speech, as intensity in words' relationships, perhaps prayer is deepened speech, where the articulation of self goes as profound as it can. Thank you. Oh, and I was going to finish with one more poem, so that's good. There are so many things to say about this, and I'm such a wonderful person to explore them with. But I wanted to end, perhaps, with a poem about Charles Darwin. I was thinking of the openness of poetry and of prayer. This is from a moment when he's published the Origin of Species. He was, his wife, who is a practicing Christian, he knew it grieved her that some of the insights that he had into science seemed to, as she put it, put God further off. But her presence beside him meant he was very, very careful in how he wrote about man in the Origin of Species. And this is a year after its publication. It's called The Open Window. He's glad that she is glad. He has not publicly rejected a creator, and he hardly mentioned man. Psychology will now be based on a new foundation, the acquirement of each necessary power, capacity by gradation. That was all. The soon-to-be Archbishop of Canterbury explains you can indeed square evolution with a god. God operates through the slow work of natural cause. He gets a fan letter from Charles Kingsley, novelist. Even better than making the world, God makes the world make itself. He watches her smile and open a window for fresh air. Religion, the burned heart in its thorns. A rock face shot with quartz on which the sun shines as it rises, lighting the rock to fire.
One of the rather annoying clichés that people constantly repeat about us Welsh is that, of course, we have a bardic tradition. And people think of the bardic tradition as something that is wild and windy and a bit verbose and deeply creative and exciting and appropriate for people with untrimmed hair and beards and flowing robes and so forth. And the truth is rather different. The truth is that the bardic tradition, especially in the Middle Ages, was a tradition of intense discipline. Welsh poetry, at its peak in the Middle Ages, set out to make difficulties for itself. Because of the conviction, which Ruth's observations have already strongly hinted at, the conviction that when you try and make language difficult, you discover things. You discover what you didn't know you knew and didn't know was there to be known. And so by the 15th century, classical Welsh poetry had evolved 24 different metrical disciplines, which remain the cornerstone of classical Welsh poetry to the present day. 24 metrical disciplines which obliged you to write in complicated patterns of rhyme, internal rhyme, assonance, echo, and so forth. Because by forcing yourself into this very strict mold, you discover something. If you're trying to write even in the least disciplined way using rhyme, you discover that your choices are limited as to what you can say, and you discover connections and echoes that you didn't know were there. I might add that one 15th century Welsh poet called Dafydd Ab Edmund devised two more classical metrical disciplines in addition to the 24 already existing, that was so difficult that nobody except Dafydd Ab Edmund ever managed to write them again. But this theme of difficulty seems to me to be one where prayer and poetry do overlap. Ruth spoke about resisting easy speech, and I think that is very much at the heart of it. We are aware, uneasily, excitedly, expectantly, at certain moments of our experience, we're aware of connections round the corner, connections we can't quite put our finger on, a sense of how things relate to one another within a mysterious but intelligible world. And in order to allow those hidden connections to impact upon us and somehow come a bit closer to the surface, we have to suspend a great deal of what we take for granted. We have to listen. To listen, we have to be quiet. To be quiet means putting your own agenda on hold for a while. Those poets who have said, "I don't know what I want to say until I've said it," express a very important dimension of this. You don't write a poem because you've got a nice, clear message to convey, and it strikes you that it might sound a bit nicer if you chopped up the lines like that. You write a poem because some kind of connectedness is pressing upon you, some kind of wobbly, uncertain fusion of the boundaries between things and persons and situations. And you want to catch that fusion, that overlap. And so you try and still the agenda, the busyness, and allow something of the connection to come through. And that is very near the heart of prayerfulness. Come to prayer with a fixed agenda, a clear sense of what you want from God, or even a clear sense of what the God you're addressing is like. You may very well find that what comes to you, what comes back to you, is just a hugely amplified echo of you. And you want to be quiet so that the connections can come through, so that you can, in some sense, align yourself with truth, reality, life. The Christian praying is someone trying to align herself or himself with that extraordinary cosmic rhythm which is the outgoing and return of the Father and the Son, as we say theologically, the outpouring of divine life and the mirroring back of divine life, which we call Father and Son, overflowing constantly in the life that we call the Holy Spirit. When we pray, we try and drop into that. We don't try and capture it. We don't try and channel it. We jump in and hope rather desperately that we might be able to swim. And Griffiths, the great 18th century Welsh hymn writer, sorry to be so Welsh, spoke of what she was dealing with as a poet and as a woman of prayer, as entering into a river to swim in but not to cross over. A river to swim in but not to cross over. And that says a great deal about the search of the poet and the praying person to align themselves, to be carried. Not that we need a kind of sentimental, romantic language about how the poet is overtaken by the muse, which then dictates, any more than in prayer, you can expect every time that somehow you'll be swept along on a great wave of ecstasy. If only, in both cases. But in order to get to that point where you might begin to see the connections coming alive, where you might begin to sense an alignment with the truth, you make things difficult. You shut up. You sit still. When you pray, you watch your breath. You watch your posture. You try to make your body receptive and alert, but not tense. You deliberately frustrate your desire to get a clear message and a simple picture. You live in that expectancy which is related to what T.S. Eliot famously called negative capability, picking up from Keats. Negative capability, the capacity to sit still with things unresolved, content to wait so that something can come through that you hadn't planned and hadn't known, or hadn't known was there to be known, as I said earlier. And when the words come and when the insights come, on the far side of that, on what one great Polish writer called the other side of silence, though it's a phrase that George Eliot also uses famously in Middlemarch, when you get to the other side of silence, the words are going to be a bit different. They're not going to be, you hope, clichés. They're going to be words that give a new map of things. You don't quite know how it's happened. I want to finish my part of this at this stage with bits of three pieces, if I may. And my first is from one of my favorite poets, W.H. Auden. And what I think is one of his most extraordinary achievements, which is the sequence of poems he wrote in the early 50s called Hore Kanonice. A sequence of poems based on the services of the monastic day. Lord Terse, Sext, None, Compline, Vespers, and so on. It's a series of poems about, well, at least three levels. It's a day in the life of a human being. It's a day in the life of prayer. And it is Good Friday. In Compline, which I find the most moving of these poems, Auden refers several times to what happened between noon and 3 o'clock, some mysterious event which has changed everything, and you can't quite put your finger on it, the hours when Christ hung on the cross. And as the human consciousness winds down into sleep, the poet thinks about sleeping, dreaming, the mysterious, uneasy memory surrounding everything of what happened between noon and three. Asks about how you pray at the end of the day, how you're saved, and ends with a glimpse of the great Greek word perichoresis, the interpenetration, interaction, dance of life around the central event. I'll just read part of the Compline. A stride from now will take me into dream. Leave me without a status among its unwashed tribes of wishes who have no dances and no jokes, but a magic cult to propitiate what happens from noon till three. Odd rites which they hide from me, should I chance, say, on youths in an oak wood insulting a white deer, bribes nor threats will get them to blab. And then, past untruth is one step to nothing. For the end, for me as for cities, is total absence. What comes to be must go back into non-being for the sake of the equity, the rhythm past measure or comprehending. Can poets, can men in television be saved? It is not easy to believe in unknowable justice or pray in the name of a love whose name one's forgotten. Libera me, libera si, dear si, and all poor sons of bitches who never do anything properly, spare us in the youngest day when all are shaken awake. Facts are facts. shall know exactly what happened today, between noon and three, that we too may come to the picnic with nothing to hide. Join the dance as it moves in perichoresis, turns about the abiding tree. My second piece is from someone that Ruth and I both deeply admire, and that is Geoffrey Hill, for my money, the finest English poet of our generation. From his book, The Triumph of Love. Geoffrey Hill is a formidably difficult poet by any standards, but here he is reflecting on grace and unexpected connections and what emerges from the difficult engagement. It begins with a phrase from the anthem to the Blessed Virgin Mary that's sung after compline, "Turn your eyes towards us, oculos tuus ad nos converte," and addresses, in the language of Dante, the Blessed Virgin Mary, Vergine Bella. Oculos tuos ad nos converte. Convert your eyes, Vergine Bella. You gave us a bit of a turn there. Not unnaturally, but not naturally either, they conceived light to be the prime agent or mover of generation. And as that light embraced you, so you embraced this conception, became secured by the eternal, its mortal source and tenure. Though many, perhaps most, would argue against the relevance of the scholastics. What do you mean, what have they to do with it? And have I studied the skeptical chemist? Salt, sulfur, mercury, more potent by far than metaphysics, whose demoted angels have been caught dancing with impropriety. Whose impropriety? Mea culpa, mum, a nervous tort. Since when has our ultimate reprobation turned, oculos tuos ad nos converte, on the conversion or reconversion of brain chemicals, the taking up of serotonin? I must confess to receiving the latest elements, Vergine Bella, as a signal mystery, mercy of these latter days. No matter that the grace is so belated, no matter who staked out and reaps the patent commodity, no matter how grace is confused repeatedly with chill euphoria. Ad te suspiramus, gementes fentes. We sigh to thee, groaning and crying, which being interpreted, commits and commends us to loving desperately, yet not with despair, not even in desperation. And finally, if I may, a poem whose origins are, I got it here. Sorry. Yes, its origins are in Nagasaki. Visiting Nagasaki last year, I was shown a rosary that was found beside the remains, such as they were, of a woman in the city after the bomb blast. Her name was Midori Nagai. Her husband was professor of radiology at the university, and after the war became a very prominent Christian spokesperson in Japan. And there's a little museum devoted to his memory in Nagasaki, where this rosary is kept, and I was shown it by his grandson. The rosary is fused, melted, almost shapeless. And the third stanza of this poem is about another event in the same period, where a Jesuit priest found himself saying mass in Hiroshima just after the bomb there. So this is called Nagasaki, Midori's Rosary. The air is full of blurred words. Something has changed in the war's weather. The children, whose children will show me this, have been sent to the country. The and the radiology lab, Takashi fiddles, listening to the ticking bomb in his blood cells, thinks once piercingly of her hands and small mouth, knotting him into the long recital of silent lies under the city's surface, the ripple of blurred Latin, changing nothing in the weather of death and confession. Thinks once in mid-morning of the kitchen floor, flash frozen. When in the starburst's centre, the little black mouth opens, then clenches, and the flaying wind smooths down the grass and prints its news black on bright, blinding walls. When it sucks back the milk and breath and skin, and all the world's vowels drown in flayed throats, the hard things, bone and tooth, fuse into consonants of stone. Midori's beads melt in a single mass around the shadow with its blackened hands, carved with their little weeping lips. Days earlier in Hiroshima, in what was left of the clinic chapel, little Don Pedro, turning from the altar to say, "The Lord be with you," heard suddenly what he was about to claim, seeing the black lips, the melted bones. And so, he said, he stood, his small mouth open, he never knew how long, his hands out like a starburst, while the dialogue of stony, voiceless consonants ground across the floor like gravel in the wind, and the two black mouths opened against each other, nobody knowing for a while which one would swallow which.